on Allen Parkway, then march to Eleanor Tinsley Park. Be there. Together, we are stronger. This is Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT, Houston. Radio for peace.
That unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals it is 8 p.m. on Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, and alongside a team that is absolutely saturated in talent, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, standout guest host Eric Heen, Christy Gorman, and Harwood Taylor, and the newest addition to our team, engineer Justin O'Neill. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who show us how stories connect us. One of my great fascinations is old Hollywood, the characters who made it and made themselves into legends. Tonight, we'll enjoy stories about that fascinating time and place by someone who was born and raised smack dab in the middle of it all, who also happens to be the author of the best-selling Letters from Hollywood, along with Growing Up in Hollywood and How I Broke into Hollywood. Rocky Lang has been involved in the motion picture and television business all of his life. His father was the producer and Universal Studios executive, Jennings Lang, and his mother, Monica Lewis, was an actor and jazz singer who was the voice of Chiquita Banana and appeared on Ed Sullivan's very first program. That's a cool little note. Rocky has produced, written, and directed motion pictures, documentaries, television shows, movies of the week, and miniseries. And I know I'm just barely scratching the surface of this multi-dimensional career. Rocky Lang, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Hey, thanks for reaching out to me. I really appreciate it. And hello, Texas.
Well, I wanted you on when I just saw your book online and read about it. But once I got the book in my hands, I said, I have to have him on. I literally read the book cover to cover in one sitting and then have used it for reference time and again.
Well, thanks a lot. It was quite a journey. The book started out quite innocently. 3 years ago, as you mentioned in your intro, my father was a producer. He did 35 films, including Earthquake and the Airport series, and he gave Spielberg his first break with Sugarland Express as a feature, and Clint Eastwood his first directorial film with High Plains Drifter. And so, anyway, my dad and I were very, very close, and I received a letter from the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, which I was surprised to get. I'm a Directors Guild member, but not an Academy member. And I opened the letter, and the cover letter said, "Dear Rocky, you probably don't remember me, but I was the assistant librarian at the American Film Institute when you were a directing fellow back in 1980, and I'm now the acquisitions archivist at the Margaret Herrick Library, which is the library of the Academy. His name is Howard Prouty." And I didn't remember Howard, but then I turned the page, and then sitting in front of me was a letter dated 1939, written by my father to the famous literary agent H.N. Swanson, who represented Fitzgerald and Gertrude Stein and a number of other, you know, and then Elmer Leonard much, much later. And my dad was just off the train from New York. He had, you know, $50-$100 in his pocket, and he was looking for a job as an agent. And I could see in this letter my dad's soul. I could see his heart and his humor and everything that I knew. And at the time of the letter, he was only 24 years old. And so, of course, I called Howard and I said, you know, thank you so much. This means so much to me. Can I take you to lunch? So after lunch, Howard took me over to the Academy archives, where I was just astonished by the amount of material going back to the silent movie days. I mean, they have 12 million images alone, and God knows how many other records of letters and, you know, gas receipts from stars. I mean, there's basically everything there. And on the way home, I called my agent, and I said, you know, I just had this experience, and I think there's a book called Letters from Hollywood. And he liked the idea. And then, like all good ideas, when I got home, I was like, okay, Letters from Hollywood. Like, how the hell am I going to do this book? I mean, I'm not an archivist. I'm not a historian. And so I partnered with a great woman named Barbara Hall, who's had 30 years in the business as an archivist and a historian, and she sort of knew where the bodies were buried. And we sold the book very quickly to Abrams Books, and we started on this journey of uncovering letters, which took us to libraries, took us across the country to archives. We looked in the Library of Congress. We looked in the Kennedy Library. We looked in the Ransom Center. I mean, just on and on and on. Of course, all the phenomenal places here in Los Angeles, AFI, UCLA, USC, Loyola, and all of those places. And the result was 137 letters, you know, culled from about 800 that we looked at. And the book has done phenomenally well and has gotten, you know, Vanity Fair and the New York Times and Washington Post and, you know, Variety, I mean, Hollywood Reporter, L.A. Times. I mean, it's just gone on and on. Not NPR. We did an interview with them. And nobody expected this. And it's just been a wonderful, wonderful experience all across the board. And I don't know how much more you want to go into it, but one of the great joys of this project was I had to clear the rights for the use of the letters, which meant I had to find the heirs to the great icons. And so that took me to, you know, Boris Karloff's daughter and Bela Lugosi's son, Bela Lugosi Jr., and Jane Fonda for Henry Fonda, and Angelica Houston for John Houston, and, you know, on and on and on, Charlie Matthau for Walter Matthau. And I started, and the great one was Danny Selznick, who's the son of David O. Selznick, and we talked about Gone with the Wind and Rebecca, and, you know, so, and the personal relationships reform, and each one of these guys and women felt the same way that I did when I received the letter, because they were hearing the words of their parents or their grandparents that were written in letters, and these were letters they had never seen, and they were as moved and they were as emotional about the letters as I was. And that in itself was fantastic, you know, just a fantastic surprise for me.
How did you decide what letters to include?
Well, that was very difficult. The one thing Barbara and I wanted to do is we tried very hard not to repeat letters, although we have a couple of Hedda Hopper letters because they're just ridiculously great and very different. But so we wanted to do it chronologically and start in the silent era. And then move all the way through the decades and be reflective of not only the special relationships of the filmmakers and the actors, but also what was sort of happening in the country at the time. So, you know, we go through the Depression, and we go through the various wars, and we go through, you know, Prohibition, and we have the, you know, the production code issues, and on, also, you know, through the 60s, Blacklist period. There's some great letters, and we have a Dalton Trumbo letter that's about the Blacklist. And so that was really the criteria. The criteria was really three things: a special relationship with two people, special relationship between the person and a project, or how is it relevant to what was happening in the country at the same time that reflected back on the film industry.
Approximately how many did you know personally of the people that were in your letters?
Well, I don't know that. I can't give you that an accurate answer, but what I did try to do, I mean, I could get it for you, but I've never thought about that. What I try to do is to put as many people in the book that I had some relationship, you know, with at some time, either me or my father. So, for instance, you know, just off the top of my head, you know, there's a George Roy Hill letter and there's a Walter Matthau letter. There's probably a half a dozen other ones that might, you know, Billy Wilder. Probably a handful of them that I actually, you know, knew or had some sort of, you know, connection to. But most of them were people I had never met.
Well, that's pretty special. And you mentioned that both of your parents were in show business, and you mentioned you had a story about growing up in that world and how it influenced you in your career. Would you share that with us?
Well, there are a lot of stories, you know, of me growing up in Hollywood, and, you know, a lot of them are documented in my book, Growing Up Hollywood, which is sort of, I hope people find very funny, because they sort of self-deprecating look at the longevity of my father's career and my relationship with him. But I think growing up in Hollywood was really interesting for me because there was an incredibly huge life, and there are movie stars, you know, coming in and out of the house all the time. Especially when my father had a movie going. But because both of my parents were Depression kids, And they had very hard upbringings, very hard lives, and both of them worked very hard to get their success. They always kept a grounded atmosphere for me in the house, and I went to public schools, and you know, I did all the normal things, and I had to do homework, and you know, I was not entitled to do like what people perceive as like the 90210. And whenever we did travel to third world countries, including places like Pakistan or India, or even other cities, you know, my father would make it a point to take me, you know, with a driver and show me the ghettos, show me how fortunate, you know, our life was and how America was versus that. So that was a grounding experience for me growing up. But, you know, there are stories that are quite, you know, fantastic and crazy Hollywood stories that are in the book, Growing Up Hollywood.
You mentioned one about the Beatles.
Oh, the Beatles. Okay, well, my parents were very involved with the Democratic Party, and when Daniel Ellsberg was mounting his defense for the Pentagon Papers trial, that we had a big blowout party with the American Civil Liberties Union to raise money for his defense. And, you know, everybody was there. I mean, Hugh Hefner was there, and all the movie stars were there. And, in fact, you know, before the Beatles experience for me was, as I was, you know, probably 11 or 12 years old, and you know, I'm walking around the backyard with my friend, and here comes like out of the bushes Hugh Hefner and Barbie Benton, and he's like zipping up his fly, and I was like, whoa, you know. And then, you know, go inside, and you know, we had this party, and then the next morning I get up and my mom is in the kitchen, and she's telling me that that the Beatles had come in late, and of course I missed them, and she told me she was sorry to not wake me up. But they came in late, and they were smoking their joints in our living room. And my parents had this incredible Miro sculpture, which, you know, is very abstract, with a, you know, hole in it. And they thought that was a, you know, an ashtray, so they were putting their ashes out, you know, in this Miro sculpture. And so those were, you know, that was sort of life in Beverly Hills, which was not the grounded side; it was the eccentric, crazy Hollywood side.
So, did y'all remove the joints, or did that become a part of the sculpture from then on?
You know, if I was older, I'd probably say, let's keep the joints. The Beatles joints will be worth more than the Miro sculpture, but
absolutely,
that didn't happen.
How did your folks, coming from a Depression-era background, how did they feel about you following in their footsteps?
Well, you know, it was really interesting. I came to that sort of on my own and sort of very innocently. You know, I wanted to be a heart surgeon when I was, you know, like 8, 9, 10. And you know, I followed the, you know, the heart transplant you know, the Bakey, and then the transplants actually in your town in Houston, you know, with the Bakey and Cooley and the race for the first human heart transplant. And it was a really interesting thing to me. And that's sort of like, I thought maybe I would go in that direction when I was really young, but I got to be 12 years old, and it really sort of started this way, where I didn't really like writing school papers. So I asked my teacher if I could write movie scripts based on the books we were reading and then go shoot them. And so the first movie I ever made was The Outsiders by S.C. Hinton, which was a book we read in class. And that sort of, you know, that turned out pretty well. And so that sort of kicked me off on the way. And when my dad saw that I was, you know, pretty serious about it when I was, you know, 15 or 16, you know, he was encouraging, but he wasn't pushy. Neither one of my parents, you know, directed me. I was directed. But again, because of the life, and you bring it back, is that, you know, for instance, Steven Spielberg, before he was Steven Spielberg, when he was just a kid doing, you know, episodic TV on the Universal lot, you know, he would be over to the house with his girlfriend, who also was from, I think she was also from Houston, his first girlfriend, serious girlfriend. And he became sort of my big brother, because my oldest brother was away in college. And my youngest brother was also, he was working out of town. And so Steve became sort of my best buddy as an older guy. He's 10 years older than me. And, you know, I had keys to his house. He lived on Lookout Mountain, and he had this old beat-up, you know, cop car from Sugar Land called 2311 with a million bullet holes in it, and he let me – I drove that to prom. I drove around this old police car, you know. And so he sort of got me really moving in the direction that, you know, this was a serious deal for me. And so in high school, by that time I had directed 60 live television shows, you know, community service things, news and, you know, reports on dog adoptions and whatever that was. And then, you know, that took me into college at UCLA. But then I got a fellowship at the American Film Institute after I made a movie, a documentary movie called When Hollywood Comes to Brooklyn, which was basically looking at Borough Park when a production company came into the city, and how these people who had never left the borough, never even went over to Manhattan, you know, they were born there, they had children there, they went to, you know, school there, or they died there, and all of a sudden this film company comes into Borough Park with the writer of the film, also from the neighborhood. And so what I did is documented the summer about how the neighborhood became involved so much in the film, and how it brought so much joy and brought all this, you know, great camaraderie to this neighborhood. And that was my first one. And then that ultimately got me into, I believe it was when it was either before or after, but then I met Sidney Pollack, and I pitched Sidney a project, which was doing another documentary on the making of Tootsie, but not the typical promotional documentary. I wanted to do a study of the actor-director relationship, and he loved that idea because Sidney came from the Meisner School of teaching acting, and the ensemble of the cast was very demanding because you had Dustin, who came from method acting, and Terry Garr, who came from method acting, and Jessica Lange, who didn't want to talk about anything, just want to read the script and show up on set. Bill Murray, who didn't even follow the text. So you had you know, these incredible egos who came to the character, you know, from a very different perspective, and they're here with Sidney, you know, at the helm of this, and, you know, just deftly managing all these, you know, all these people and how they approach the character. And so that was exactly what I had pitched to Sidney on how to do it. So that became part of the documentary, and nobody knew at the time that Tootsie would become such a success, but it also became, you know, the major fights and lawsuits that were happening, almost the shutdown of the production because of the legendary fights between Sidney and Dustin. And, you know, I was right in the middle of all of it because Sidney said to me at the beginning when I asked him, I said, I want carte blanche. If we're going to do an honest portrayal of this film, I need to be in on it. So I was in on the fights, and I was in all the disagreements, and I was in this Columbia parking lot with Dustin, walking from the screening room, you know, when Dustin was spewing at Sidney, he was standing on the second floor balcony because he hated the cut of the movie, he hated the way it went, and ultimately, you know, Dustin was proved wrong because the film was so fantastic. But, you know, it was a great experience. Here, there I was at 24 years old.
Okay, I want to see that film and when Hollywood comes to Brooklyn.
All right, we'll work on that offline.
I have a feeling that I'll be hosting some Rocky Lange evenings pretty soon.
All right. Well, yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, Sidney, outside of my father, was for sure the most influence on me as a director. And, you know, all through this, when you got the original question about my dad, I mean, my dad and my mom, they were happy if I was happy. I mean, I was under no illusions how difficult the film was. I knew that there were going to be benefits to having my dad, you know, make some calls for me along the way. But ultimately, because what I was doing is I wanted to direct, you know, no one was going to, you know, give me a lot of money to go direct a film. Whereas, you know, sometimes in the business, they call someone, like, my kid wants to be an agent, can you put him in the mailroom, or he wants to be here or do that. And those doors get opened more frequently. But that's talking about paying someone $250 a week as a starting agent. It's not saying, you know, here's $3 million, $6 million to go make a movie. And my feature films, you know, were all like that. They were all like hustled by myself and, you know, got them made by hook or by crook. And that sort of got my feature career in order after I directed some Remington Steels. And so parents,
another
dad,
great
mom
program.
Were supportive. I'm sorry?
Another great program
and a great opportunity. Yeah. Really
now, one
great.
Of my all-time favorite movies, all-time favorites, is The Apartment with Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, and Fred McMurray.
Right.
So would you tell us the story of your surprising connection to the film?
Okay, this could be a little bit of a long story or short story. So I'm going to start long, and you cut me off if it gets in the way.
All right.
Going back to Letters from Hollywood, my book, one of the letters that we found was an incredible love letter from Gilbert Roland to the It girl Clara Bow. And for those of your listeners who are unfamiliar with these names, is Roland was a very handsome, debonair, you know, silent movie star who was one of the few who actually transitioned into talkies. And Clara Bow was probably the sex star of the era. She was absolutely stunningly beautiful. And she had a very tough life in and out of sort of mental hospitals. And she had had this affair with Roland during a movie they made in the early 20s called The Plastic Age. And so many, many years later, Bo was recovering from, you know, another one of her breakdowns in a sanitarium. And Roland had heard that, and he wrote this beautiful, touching letter to her reminiscing about their love affair and the times that they made these great movies, which was really the highlight of their lives and their careers. And so I had to go and find the heirs to Gilbert Roland to get permission to use the letter. And I looked for a long time. I couldn't find her, and I finally hired a private investigator named Dave Gervitz, and he found her actually like 10 or 15 minutes from me, but she was way under the radar, so all my sources couldn't find her. And she read the letter, and she said to me, look, I really love the letter. I love your project, and I'm inclined to give you the okay to do it, but I need to see you face-to-face. I said, all right, fine. I'm always happy to meet people, but so I kept looking at the letter. What can she talk to me about? It's a simple letter. So I called David Sten, who is the writer of the best book or the most complete book on Clara Bow called Running Wild. And I said, David, can you source this letter? Because I don't know what she's looking at. So he started laughing. He says, well, who do you think her mother is? I said, I don't know who her mother is. Her dad's Gilbert Roland. Well, does the name Constance Bennett mean anything to you? And I went, holy crap. And so to shortcut this, Constance Bennett, it was Joan Bennett's sister, and that Joan Bennett had an affair with my father back in the early 50s in 1949, 1950. And Walter Wanger, who was a wonderful producer, he did Cleopatra, he did I Want to Live, he did, you know, Ride and Sell Brock 11. He was a great, great Invasion of the Body Snatchers, just a wonderful producer. He, like, you know, he found out about this, and he tried to shoot my dad in the nuts, and he actually shot my dad, and the rumor was Jennings Langs was shot in the balls, and that was sort of the rumor till I got old enough to say, basically, he didn't get shot in the balls or I wouldn't be here today. but so anyway, to make this story go long, David Sten's laughing at me, and he says, you know, she's going to ask you if Walter really did shoot your dad in the balls. And I said, no, she's not. How could she possibly do that? He says, no, you don't understand. This was a big thing in the Wanger-Bennett family. You know, her mother and her sister had to be moved out of L.A. because the press was so hot on this. It was on every gossip column, you know, column all over the place, the front page of the L.A. Times. So, you know, that whole thing really disrupted their lives, and that's why she's going to ask you. And so we meet at this little coffee shop she wanted to go to called Patty's, and she shows up. She's, you know, she's probably 80, and she's, you know, quite beautiful, and her hair is done nicely, and she's in this bright-colored, you know, suit, and she drives up in a convertible, and, you know, she's got a cane, and she walks in, and we have this, like, little chit-chat, and I can see she's a little uncomfortable, but I'm not going to give anything away. And then she sort of leans into the table, and she says, you do know who I am, don't you? And I said, yes, Jill, I do. And then she says, yeah, and you do know that I know who you are. And I said, yes, I assume that, yes. And then there's this, like, long, dramatic, you know, pregnant pause. And she says, well? And I say, well, what? Well, was Walter accurate? And I said to her, no, he wasn't accurate, or I wouldn't be here sitting having breakfast with you. So she started to laugh, and she started to crack up, and, you know, I asked her something else, and I said to her, I said, you know, Jill, is there anything you want to tell me about your dad that, you know, would be interesting? And she says, well, my dad was a philanderer, and he was also liked fast cars. My mom probably soon left him, took me and my sister to Germany, but I would come back on the summers. And she says, I could only count on one thing from my dad every summer, is he'd have a different automobile, but in the glove compartment of each automobile were Greta Garbo's underwear. Cool. So how does this relate to your question? It relates to the question is that Billy Wilder and I.E. Diamond had watched this case, this Walter Wanger situation, develop, and that became the genesis of the apartment.
Wow. Wow. How old were you when you learned this story?
Well, I learned the story when I was 13, and it's actually the first chapter of Growing Up Hollywood. And it's called My Mother Told Me Your Father Was Shot in the Balls. And I was 13 years old, playing on the blacktop at my elementary school before school. I always play basketball in the mornings. And my best friend comes running across this huge blacktop, yelling at the top of his lungs, hey, Lang, my mother said your father was shot in the balls. Hey, Lang, my mother said your father was shot in the balls. You know, the whole parking, the whole blacktop, and everybody stops. It's like, you know, and they're looking, you know, what the hell's going to happen? I'm like, what are you talking about? So he tells me this story. So then from like 8 o'clock when school started all the way to the time I was going to get home, I was thinking about this, and what did this all mean? And I was getting questions from all my friends. So, like, you know, I run into the house at the end after biking home, and I, you know, go to the lady who worked for us, and I said, you know, Mary, was my dad shot in the balls? And she's like, go ask your mother. And I run up the stairs, and my mom banging into her bathroom. Mom, Andy Stewart said dad was shot in the balls. And my mom says, wait till your father comes home. You know, and I'm waiting for my dad to come home. And then he comes in, and I talk to him about it, and he tells me the story. And, you know, he's like, look, you know, everybody made a mistake here, and you know, but, you know, everything turned out okay. And, you know, he sort of downplayed it a little bit. And that's how I found out about it. And then in subsequent years, I learned more about it. And what was really fascinating about the story is that there was a letter that we found, which I thought was fantastic, and it was from Walter Wanger, the shooter, to Joseph Mankiewicz, who's, you know, one of the great writer directors producers in Hollywood, and he wrote this letter about writing about a project that he found called I Want to Live, which Susan Hayward was starring in, and she ultimately won the Academy Award. And he wrote it after he came out of jail. He was sent to a prison farm for 6 months. My dad didn't prosecute against him, but the city did. The city of Beverly Hills did. And so when he came out, he did these two great prison movies. And so in the process of this, I called Stephanie Guest, who is the daughter of Joan Bennett and Walter Wanger, and I said, found this great letter from your dad. Now, remember, her dad shot my dad, okay? So I call, I have this great letter, you know, that your dad wrote to Mankiewicz. It's fantastic. I want to put it in the book. And so she wrote back to me. She says, I'm horrified in, like, you know, fonts like 55. I'm horrified that you would ask me to do this. I figured, okay, well, she's obviously mad at me, you know, even though my dad's been dead, whatever. And then the way this, we didn't use the letter, and the wonderful part of the letter is 2 months later, I was contacted by Vanessa Hope, who is Walter Wanger and Joan Bennett's granddaughter, and she's a very wonderful woman, a great filmmaker, very smart. And she contacted me. She said, I'd like to interview for a documentary I'm doing on my grandparents, and I'd like to talk about the shooting. And I said to her, you know, look, you and I, neither one of us was born at the time. I don't know how much I can add. And she said, I still want to interview. So she came to the house, and she brought me this, you know, present, and she had this film crew, and she's absolutely wonderful and fantastic. And we had this, you know, great interview, and then went to lunch, and she revealed things about Wanger that had her grandfather that I had never known. I always felt that my dad was the bad guy, but, you know, in the affair, and Joan was part of it too, but it turns out that Wanger had been, you know, sleeping with women 2 months after he married Joan Bennett, and he was as big a gigolo as anyone else. But when it was his wife who did it, he, you know, blew a gasket. So that's how it all tied into the letter and letters from Hollywood and the department and all of that.
And I'm telling you, people, we are just hitting the tip of the iceberg of what's in these books. If you are interested in this, you'll want to run and order these books from your local bookseller because every story leads into another story. Your dad sounds like a truly larger-than-life character in every possible way. And you mentioned you've got a story about your own adventures with him.
Yes, that's really what Growing in Hollywood is about. It's about my adventures with my father, and there are many adventures. But you know, I'll tell you one sort of short one, which is pretty crazy. It was the summer of 1977, and for, you know, what was going on, and it was in New York, and what was happening in New York at that time. There was a Son of Sam in New York, and Saturday Night Fever had just broke in 1976, and so disco was the run. The Yankees and Dodgers were in a, you know, tight race in the World Series. It was the year of Reggie Jackson and Bob Welsh and all that, the crazy stuff, the home runs. And Con Ed Blackout was there. So it was a nutty, hot summer in New York. And my dad was making a movie called Nunzio in Brooklyn. And it was a very small movie. He had been doing these big disaster films, and he wanted to come back to his neighborhood and make a film, this very sort of small film called Nunzio. And the production manager was approached by the local mob, who said, "Look, you need to hire, you know, more of our drivers onto the film, or we're going to, you know, not let your trucks roll. We're going to cut your tires and not let break down production." And so, you know, it was a small film and a small budget. So my dad had to, like, make a deal with the mob. So one night, he calls me up. I was been working at a company called General Camera, sort of learning how to put battery packs together and lenses. I was like sweeping the floors at a camera rental house, sort of learning the whole equipment side. And he says, you know, let's go. I want to take you to dinner tonight. So I went over to his hotel, and, you know, we got in his limo, and we went up to Harlem. And Harlem at that time was not what Harlem is today. It was, you know, there was a lot of drugs, a lot of violence. But there was this one street we turned down, and like there was never any violence in it, because at the very end of the street there's a restaurant called Rao's, and now Rao's has, you know, their Italian sauce in all the stores. But at the time it was very small and well known, and it was mob operated, mob owned. And so we walk in there, it's very small and very Italian, and it turned out that one of the underbosses at the time liked to de-stress himself by going in there a couple of times a week and being the cook. He was a very good cook. And so, you know, I'm going to change some of these names. I don't think any of these guys are alive anymore. But, you know, we go in there and, you know, we sit down, and there's like Carmen and Vinny and Sal and, you know, that whole group. And the cook who's the guy my dad made this deal with, you know, comes over to the table and he's talking. He's so friendly. Everybody's so friendly. And my dad says, hey, you know, why don't you take Rocky back and show him the lettuce? And so he laughs, and so he takes me back, and it's like this Rocky kitchen, you know, with the beef, the cow hanging from the thing in a meat freezer, and all this crap going on. And he takes me back to this smaller, like, refrigerator freezer, and he opens it up, and there's like four heads of lettuce that are like just iced over. He couldn't possibly eat it, but they're in there. And he pulls them out, and behind it is like just a mound of cash. I think there's probably like 200 grand in there. You know, for me, it looked like $1 million at the time. And then he laughs. And he put it away. Well, that was actually the payoff in order for them to roll their trucks to make the movie, and they got the movie made. So that's one of 15 stories about me and my dad, you know, in the book, and what I got exposed to. And all through it, he was just the best dad, you know, just the greatest guy.
I mean, I think he must have been, because the sense I got is I could see how a young person could look at this father and this amazing man and say, I can't compete. I got to go into a completely different field. But I don't get the sense that you felt that way.
I never felt that way, I mean, about it. And also, I was going in a very different direction. I mean, he was an agent and a producer and a studio executive. And I was always interested in narrative storytelling, you know, even from the time I was 12 making these little movies. And so my you know, course was always to be a director. And I did, you know, I took acting classes with the, you know, with the, I'm losing my mind, whatever it is. It very, very serious. I hate when I lose it. But it's like a Meisner class. It's another method class. And I learned the film. I learned everything I could do and to take myself to a director, and taught myself how to write, and taught myself how to. I carried a book around with me for, you know, years. I still have this book. I saw it the other day. That, you know, I noted everything. I knew everything, all the advice people had given me. You know, how to work a camera around a room, and how to get out of bad situations, and how to do a moving master in order to set up different coverages to make the timing short, because in TV, you know, you need to get through the day. And so, but my dad was always encouraging me to do what I wanted to do. And also, our relationship was also very much built about our shared love of sports and our shared love of art. And so we had this sort of multidimensional relationship, and that covered a lot of things other than the movie business. And in fact, in the movie business, you know, he was a little hard on me, but not for the reasons you would think, just to be more conscious of budget and schedule and things like that, to be aware that there's a responsibility that came with being a director, which was great, not great experience for me, because when I moved to doing more producing, I became very conscious of that and imported that onto my directors and the writers that I were working with about, you know, what we needed to do to, you know, make a good project and stay within our budget and still be free for them to sort of create.
Well, he sounds like an amazing guy, and I'm glad for both you and he that Wenger was a bad shot.
Yeah, I am too, actually.
Well, friends, this is Greg Audell with Justin O'Neill running the control room, and you are listening to my guest storyteller, Rocky Lang, on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica, KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And Justin, this is our first time working together, inaugural show.
It is.
And you have been doing a great job.
Thank you.
People have been able to hear. You know, we always got to be nice to Justin because he controls whether people can hear us or not. You know, and for listeners who might not have tuned in the last couple weeks, would you just take a minute and introduce yourself to our audience? Because you're going to be hearing from Justin in the coming many, many shows from now.
Yep. So I am currently an HCC audio student. And I will be graduating in May, actually. So I'm in my last semester, and I'm also a part-time barista on the weekends.
Oh, wow. I know who to call when I need a coffee fix.
Yep.
Well, we are very happy to have you on the team. What do you think of the stories you're hearing tonight?
They're really great. It's interesting to hear of such famous people from like a personal perspective. It's really interesting.
Makes it more real, doesn't it?
Yep.
Well, would you do us a favor and tell us about the wide world of storytelling in Houston for the next coming weeks?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a great place to start because it is a great place to learn how to craft stories. They meet on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. They kick off the new year with their next swap on January 28th. And make sure to bring a friend, and you could even make it a date night. Visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all their upcoming events. And while you're on the Guild's page, why not become a member? It's easy to do online. Also, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008, all listed under the menu under Radio Program. Don't own a radio? That's not a problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on Facebook and on YouTube. We're all over the place.
You cannot hide from us.
We'd also like you to suggest program ideas when visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with friends, and we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Got guests to suggest? Maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you.
And we don't just say that. We really will get back to you.
So don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. Our next one is February 11th, and the theme is their annual Love Hurts. And for our listeners who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Both happen to be staunch supporters of our program. And I would also like to play the jingle for the upcoming Wimberley Storytelling Festival, where some of our favorite storytellers like Harwood, Chris, Hank, Sneha, and more will be entertaining those smart enough to attend.
Everyone has a story to tell. It's a tradition as old as time. Wimberley's first storytelling fest invites you to come, listen, laugh, and learn. Look at us. We're bringing storytellers in from all over Texas, Houston, Austin, San Antone, and the Hill Country, too. Famous tellers, award-winning PBSers, indigenous elders, and local jawboners. We'll see you at 7A Ranch Opera House on 2/22/2020.
2/22/2020, the Storytelling Festival in beautiful Wimberley.
Wow. What a tune. Well, friends, the reason we tell you about each of these events is because they are filled with gifted storytellers. And if you just want to hear a great story, you will hear great stories at each and every one of these venues. And if you want to learn to become a better storyteller, you will learn from each and every one of these venues. And I'll mention with The Moth, they have been selling out, so you need to get your tickets online ahead of time, particularly for Love Hurts. Now, next week, my co-host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, will host a special program to commemorate Holocaust Remembrance Day. This is a theme that's especially profound in the world as we know it. Tune in to what will prove to be a set of reflective and inspirational stories. And I've asked our own Hank Rubicek, who is a volunteer at the Holocaust Museum in Houston, if he'd mind sharing some thoughts on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Hank?
Oh, thanks, Greg. First of all, Rocky, I'm Hank. I love your story. You know, you obviously are a storyteller by living, but you're a great personal storyteller. It's wonderful to have famous faces come very real.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, Justin put it really great. Well, next week, Greg, yeah, it's going to be a very special, special event, I think. Mary's got a great set of storytellers lined up. Holocaust Remembrance Day is the International Memorial Day commemorating the tragedy of the Holocaust, which claimed the lives of 11.5 million people. And when we think about the issue of genocide and we think about the issue of hate, there's an inextricable relationship that we never want to forget on Holocaust Remembrance Day, which specifically is January 27th, that Monday. But again, Mary's got a great set of programs lined up, and we say every week that it's a show you don't want to miss. But you know, this is Pacifica, and our adage is fueled for peace, and the notion is that we know that hate never goes away. It's an anecdote that we have to keep learning to overcome, and I think that this show is really going to do it. So we look forward to everybody tuning in next week for some great stories commemorating Holocaust Remembrance Day. Thank you.
I will absolutely be tuning in. Rocky, you still with us?
I'm here.
Can you share a story with us about the difference, since you've had a foot in both worlds, between old Hollywood and new Hollywood? In my mind, they're completely different universes.
Well, I think they are different universes. And, you know, a lot of us older guys, you know, we sort of walk the line that other older guys have done in different generations of sort of saying, oh, well, we miss the good old days. But, you know, things evolve, and every generation is entitled to, you know, seeing the world and presenting to the world what they feel. We see it in music, we see it in art, we see it in, you know, in politics, we see it all over the place. But for me, the biggest problem today is that the original story, the original idea is very difficult to sell and get to the big screen unless you are, you know, a super big writer or actor or director who can, you know, push something through. But if you go back to the great filmmakers of the 70s with Scorsese and Coppola, and then you keep going back, you know, all the way into time to, you know, Hitchcock and Mankiewicz and, you know, moving all the way back, you know, John Huston and John Ford. I mean, if you look at those great films, their character's driving plot. Plot's not driving character. It's always about a human emotion and a dilemma. And so right now I think that what happened is this multinational corporation started to buy studios, and the studio became a line item in a budget of, you know, like a Time Warner. They were just, you know, had to find a way to just be so incredibly profit-driven. And so what you see is for the majority of the big films that they are, you know, derivative from some pre-existing material that you oftentimes comic books or franchise series that have branded series that have, you know, moved through it. You see that, but it's very rare that you see these incredible, you know, movies that say something except at the Academy Awards. And then, you know, those few movies sneak through and they get seen. And those films like a 1917 or a Jojo Rabbit, you know, those films would probably not be able to sustain itself in the marketplace without, you know, the kind of push that they get for the Academy. And then once the Academy Award nominates, people start hearing about them, and then people come see them. But there was a time for me where the material rose to the top. The cream rose to the top based on material. So if you had something that was, you know, really well written or really well conceived, you could get someone interested in it because they would see the vision of the creative to take it from the idea all the way to film. I mean, my film that Ridley Scott directed, White Squall, was a project that started as a pitch. And it was not, there was nothing attached to it. It was me and the writer, and there's, you know, no big stars or anything else, no money. It was just a great story that we told, and they bought the project, and they developed the project, and Ridley came on the project, and Jeff Bridges came on the project. It was made. You can't do that today. It's not, because the good material is not enough. You know, it has to have all these other elements attached to it. And so for the filmmaker, at least in the theatrical side, that's very, very, it's very difficult to get anything original past. What is good is on the television side, on the premium cable side, you're seeing great writing. You're seeing great, you know, thought and filmmaking and interesting type of storytelling. And so as we've lost the ability to sort of do that on the big screen, we've gained it in the small screen. In some ways, it's really interesting. I was thinking back about my dad when he did Earthquake, because what his idea was is he was sort of shocked by the L.A. earthquake, where he came in and I was under my bed, you know, doing a duck and cover, and he thought, wow, I'm going to, you know, do this film called Earthquake. And his idea was to make it an event film. And so Sensoround was developed, which, if your audience doesn't know, was, you know, these incredible, you know, deep sort of thundering speakers that were tied to the optical track of the film. So when the earthquake happened or big rumblings thing, the whole theater would sort of shake. And when with the Chinese theater with all this ornamental stuff on the top, you know, if it shook so much, they were worried it was going to come down. So it was all netting. And so he coined the film an event. And before that time, the event, that term was never used. But it's used like all the time now, an event on ABC, an event here and there. But he believed that you needed to get do something really big and special to get people out of their houses and into the theater. And he thought it was going to get worse and worse as technology increased and that people traffic increased and people had to get a reason to get out of their house. So in some sort of humorous and sort of funny way, I blame my father for all the comic book movies and the event movies today. And he, you know, he followed that up with the airport movies and with all the stunt casting on it, and you know they weren't that great.
I loved all those movies growing up.
I'm sorry?
I loved all those
movies.
Yeah,
they're fun. They're really fun. In fact, there's Facebook pages devoted to all those films, and the earthquake one is particularly hilarious. I mean, these fans go back forever, and they're, you know, it's become sort of this cult. And so they post these pictures, and they sort of, you know, they put these, like, you know, sayings about what their log lines about what they are. And you know, I'm a member of that group, and, you know, they love when I, you know, when I chime in and I make some comment. But, yeah, they are. They have they have sort of found their way even all these years later, when, as corny as they are now.
Do you find yourself longing for the ways of Hollywood business of old?
Well, I don't know if I long for it. I feel, you know what I feel? I guess that, and it's, well, first of all, I knew that Hollywood is a young person's business. I mean, I benefited from it. I was, you know, directing at 19 and 20 years old. I did, you know, my first, you know, feature in my late 20s. And I grew up with all of these executives who started as junior executives and agents and went out to be very powerful people. And but I knew that that time would end, you know, and you're aged out so much in Hollywood, unless you're like Steven Spielberg. I mean, obviously it's a bell-shaped curve. But and so what I miss is the ability to create what is in my heart and put it to the people into the screen, because I need permission from somebody to work. And the way it works today is it's so much as committee. I'll give you a little I know you want to talk a little bit about my Lifetime movie, but you know, Lifetime Television, which is indicative of some of the other the way things work, is that everything's by committee. So, you know, we bring in a project, and, you know, we pitch the project, and they like the project, and, you know, so then they have to pitch the log line to a focus group and see what the focus group says. Then they have to pitch the treatment to a focus group, and then it's all internally discussed, and it goes through sort of, you know, a research team to sort of look at what the country's looking at, the demographics, and it goes through all this stuff. And then, you know, you make the movie, and then then the way the movie gets structured is sort of tailored to their audience, which, you know, in Lifetime's case is women, and most of them are, you know, in a certain part of the country that are looking for a certain type of material. And so it's not like you take a project and you say, you know, I want to do this, and this is how I see it, and this is who I'd like to be in it. And they go, that's a great idea. Go write it. You know, there's all this committee work. And I attribute it to, like, if there's, you know, when someone paints a painting, and obviously there's so much more money in it, so this is not, doesn't really make a lot of sense, but if someone's painting a painting, you know, you don't have someone come over and says, look, you know, your sky's too blue. I really would like to be cloudy. Can you put some clouds in it and make it gray? And I don't like the outfit that the woman at the lake has. Can you make it rather? I mean, that's what happens now. And it wasn't that much before, where the filmmaker, you know, really was given the opportunity to go, you know, pitch his ball game and surround him with the best infield and outfield they can to accomplish that. And and the producers in those days, I think, were, and I can't really talk today, but they were really supportive of the creators. And now, there's, you know, oftentimes there's none of that. It's because it's just such a machine business.
Art by committee is a very strange concept, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it. I mean, but I am happy with the way my career went, and I still have my projects I want to get made. Things come around cyclically. I mean, the project I just did at Lifetime was a project I found 7 years ago and couldn't sell it then, and it came back around a few years ago, and now it's going to be airing.
Tell us the story behind that.
Well, the story behind it is, like, I seem to have gravitated to true stories, you know, my entire life. I mean, not always, but, you know, White Squall was based on a true story. My three Lifetime movies were based on a true story. My CBS miniseries based on a true story. They seem to, things have seemed to go that way. And so I am very much of a feminist. I have, you know, two daughters, and I'm always looking for stories that are, you know, empowering for women. I wrote some for my kids that were empowering for women, one being about a woman who struck out Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig in 1933, true story. But anyway, so what happened is that this was a story that caught my eye, and in brief, about a woman who just out of law school had a party, and she was driven home by a guy and who put a hit on her, and she said no, and I mean, not a assassination hit, just, you know, hit on her, and he followed her in and he raped her, and she called the police, did the whole thing, and she wound up becoming pregnant, and she decided to keep the baby, and the guy, the rapist, who was, like, out, you know, came in and said, look, if you don't say I was consensual, I'm going to, you know, kill you and the baby. And with the story, she runs away, and she raises her kid in another state. And lo and behold, you know, 7-8 years later, this rapist shows up in that state, and he wants custody of the kid. And in that time, in the state of Florida, in that time, the law said, well, yeah, he may be a rapist, but doesn't mean he's a bad dad, and he does have biological rights. Wow. And so the story ultimately is about how this woman, you know, rises up and, you know, changes the law, gets the law changed in Florida, and that law gets, you know, becomes a template for a change in rapist rights laws around, across the country. I mean, that's a brief story. And when we did the movie, we, you know, obviously we had to do it based on and, you know, change names and change locations around. And but the essence is the same, and it's a, you know, it's quite a powerful story, and it's the kind of thing I'm attracted to. Because I would like to tell stories that make people think. And you know, most of my movies are those kind of movies where you can enjoy them, but you come away thinking about it and talking about it and questioning it.
What's the name of the film so we can be on the lookout for it?
February 15th on Lifetime Networks. It's called You Can't Take My Daughter Away.
All right.
You Can't Take My Daughter.
Wow. I will definitely be on the lookout for that. All right. Now, we've just got a few more minutes, so I'm going to shoot a few questions to you that let's see how many we can get in here. Am I right that your father was Joan Crawford's manager?
He was her agent.
Did you know her as a kid?
Joan actually lived right around the corner from my dad on Bristol in Brentwood. So they were friends, and they'd have dinner, you know, from time to time. And I've got some great stories, Joan Crawford stories, but we'll save it for another interview.
All right. Then that will be on my list. When did you realize that you were living in an unusual community of, you know, that your friend's parents were famous and your parents were?
Well, actually, that's really funny because, as I said, my dad, you know, came from this very depression baby. My dad, although we did have the Clint Eastwoods, who was actually a very good friend of my dad, a very loyal friend after my dad's stroke, he continued to visit him. And, you know, we did have the Matthaus and the Barbara Streisands and the Spielbergs and, you know, those people in and out of the house. But my dad's closest friends were either writers or directors or, you know, one of their best friends. He's a guy who built houses, and there's a tennis player, former pro, who was really great, and he had a lot of friends in the art world. You know, he'd have young painters come and stay at the house and do their work because we had a pool house in the back. And so it wasn't like, you know, it was celebrity time all the time. My mom, like, took me to school every day, and she took me to my lessons, you know, my tutor or my trumpet lesson, you know, go to Little League games. I mean, they lived this big life, you know, all this stuff. But the day-to-day thing was like, no, Mom, can you make me breakfast? No, you don't have your own breakfast. Go make your breakfast. You know, it was more like that kind of a thing. And so I did recognize that certainly as I got older, when I was very young, I had no idea. But as, you know, I got older, certainly into high school, I started to realize, you know, how incredible my life was and how fortunate I was.
Well, and when was it that you first said to yourself, I need to start writing these stories down?
Oh, I've always been writing stuff down, and I think that where growing up Hollywood came from actually came from my kids, because I had been in a meeting, you know, doing a pitch, and the woman executive had knew the story, and she said, oh, you know, Rocky, tell them the story about, you know, the ball story. So I pitched the story, and it was on my mind, and I came home. My daughters were then, you know, old enough to hear it, probably, you know, 20, 21, So I tell them the story about their grandfather, and they're like on the floor, you know, laughing, and they're saying, you know, Dad, you got to write these things down. You got to, you know, got to write this stuff for us. So I started to write these stories down, and which ultimately became a book, which became Growing Up Hollywood, which then was published, and you know, and certainly the industry, you know, really responded to it, and that's how that happened. But even right now, I've been collecting stories that I write that I'm saving for another book. I mean, I had lunch with Angeline. Do you guys know who Angeline is? Have you ever heard of Angeline?
Is she the woman who's famous for being famous and buys all the billboards?
Yeah, and she drives around a pink Corvette.
Right,
she's been doing it for like 40 years. And she's, you know, out of her mind nuts. And so, you know, I had lunch with her. I went and had lunch with her because I had this idea about sort of, you know, why is the people are attracted to celebrities who have done nothing? You know, what was the attraction of the Kardashians? You know, they didn't act, they didn't sing, they, you know, they didn't bring anything to the table, but they were the Kardashians. Same thing with Angeline, and sort of from a sociological standpoint, what drives that attraction? What's going on with it? So I was going to, I'm still thinking about it, you know, in L.A., what makes this thing tick? And Angeline was going to be, you know, a big part of it. So, you know, I went and had lunch with her, and it was a nutty lunch. And so I come back and I write this nutty story of my lunch with Angeline. And I've been doing that for years. And so now I got 50 stories, and, you know, eventually I'll put them in a book, and they're all pretty funny. They're all
and
some of our family stories.
They're
whacked out. So I'm always writing, and I'm always thinking of that stuff.
Well, I'm
very
looking forward
I think
to
a lot of writers
again.
Are. They're observationalists. You know, we go through life, and we sort of look around us and study human behavior, and we marvel at it, and we wonder what makes people tick and why they act a certain way. You know, so that's sort of like, you know, what we do.
Well, Rocky, I want to thank you for bringing some of Hollywood's great legends and the stories in your own words in Letters from Hollywood, which can be found at lettersfromhollywood.com. and your local bookstore. And tonight we shared stories of old Hollywood and the personalities who made it the focus of worldwide attention. And these stories, among many, allow us to take a peek behind a very carefully crafted curtain of image and image managers. And it's just been a thrill to have you on the show. And
well, I appreciate you reaching out to me. It's fun always to talk about my dad and my mom. And, you know, these stories are a big part of who I am. And so I appreciate it.
Well, and friends, if you want to find out more about Rocky, you can go to Rocky Lange, that's ROCKYLANG.com, or lettersfromhollywood.com.
And
I encourage
you to
happy,
you know, from time to time I do some consulting. So if any of your listeners are at all interested in some words from an old timer, I'm happy to contribute whatever I can. I'm very interested in mentoring, you know, young people and sort of opening doors that were open for me when I was young.
Well, I'll tell you, I know I'm going to be taking you up on that.
Okay, thank you.
So What's Your Story team wants to thank you for sharing this hour with us, friends. And we hope you join us each and every week throughout 2020. I promise we are never, ever going to run out of great stories or passionate storytellers. And do not touch that dial, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, along with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and along with the rest of So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that it is absolutely never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
KPFT makes a difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I was couldn't sit down. I couldn't rest all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul. You know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The Shock Doctrine, what I'm calling the Shock Doctrine, is a philosophy of power. It's a doctrine of domination.
This is radio worth supporting, and you make a difference. Visit kpft.org to view our complete program schedule. Give feedback on our shows or pledge online. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio.